This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Coming to you from Brock Lesnar's secret farm in Saskatchewan to talk about wrestling from yesteryear to today, it's the Podcast of Doom. With your hosts, Scott Keith and Brian Bayless.
All right, and welcome to this week's Podcast of Doom. I'm your host, Scott Keith, along with, of course, Brian Bayless, the hardest working man on the blog of Doom. Brian, how are you doing tonight?
Doing excellent. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, thank you. We got all kinds of crap to talk about tonight.
It's quite the weekend of wrestling.
It's quite the weekend. There's all kinds of people working themselves into a frenzy and getting themselves into fights over stuff that's may or may not be fake. So we got all kinds of things to go over here. So, of course, this was the second biggest weekend of the year with NXT TakeOver and then, of course, SummerSlam. Went through there, but of course that wasn't even the biggest things that were going on over the week. We had actually I think it was three or four different altercations going on here now. We've got injuries and all kinds of stuff. So let's start at the beginning, I guess. What'd you think of NXT TakeOver this weekend on Saturday?
I thought it was a very good show, top to bottom. Showcased some new talent. It had the tag match, it was phenomenal. I'd probably say it was the second best match of the whole weekend behind Cena and AJ Styles at SummerSlam. And Ember Moon's debut, that was great. She shows a ton of promise. I really like the show a lot. We have a new champion in Nakamura. I thought it was an excellent show.
Yeah, I thought it was great as well. I do feel like I shortchanged the tag team match a little bit in my review of it. I went back and watched it again, and yeah, it was actually fantastic. You know, I didn't think it was up there with Cena and AJ or anything like that as far as being best match of the weekend, but I mean, yeah, it was some greatness, I thought. Ember Moon is reasonably good debut, I thought. Aside from the finisher, though, like, wasn't great, but the finisher was fantastic. And what I'd actually heard going into it was, you know, everybody was saying, oh, well, you know, this chick Athena was fantastic on the indies, and everybody's going to lose their minds when she does her finisher, which I guess is called the O-face in the independents when she did it before. But no, I'm not sure what they're going to call it, probably a full moon or moon over Miami or something. I don't know. But yeah, it was fantastic. It was a twisting dive into a stunner off the top rope, which is just pretty amazing.
It looked great, too, when she hit it. It looked great.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like it could be a tricky thing, and she got it on the first try, and that counts for a lot. Speaking of finishers, Bobby Roode switching to apparently a Road Dogg's pump handle slam for his finisher was a little less impressive, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. That's a pretty tame finisher.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, even if he had stuck with like the fisherman's driver or something like that, I thought that was a perfectly good move for him, but yeah, I don't know. Pump handle slam was a little bit of a letdown after, especially the way that he'd been built up as a giant star with the entrance and the awesome theme music.
That was glorious. Wonderful.
It was really glorious, was great. You might say. Yeah,
it truly was.
Yeah, no, it was fantastic. I thought so. That was a really good debut for him. I thought just as terms of because they need stars. I mean, at this point now they're gutting NXT to the point where they, you know, they need people to come in there and be kind of mid-card stars, and Bobby Roode really fits that. Like he's a guy who can, you know, transition up and down from the mid-card to the main event like that and be believable as a top guy, which is kind of it's an important thing for them right now. It's with Finn Balor gone now, and probably Samoa Joe's got to be going up pretty soon, you have to think.
I imagine so.
At this point, given the way that things went down there. I imagine they'll still do a rematch off of that one, although Joe was selling his jaw. So that's probably building up the injury there, but thankfully that was a fake injury and not a real injury like some of the other ones were. But
right. But yeah, that was another finish that also looked great, I thought, too. Excellent finish in that match.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, Nakamura, if you need somebody to have a big match on a big show, you know, there's the guy you're going to call. And hopefully somebody in WWE picks up on that sooner rather than later and gets him up there. But good for Nakamura. He's the NXT champion now, which says, I think, you know, we were watching the match and thinking whoever lost the match was going to be the next one to go up to the main roster. So, you know, hey, hopefully Joe does well up there if that is the case. And if not, then, hey, they'll have some more great matches and everybody will be happy either way. So, yeah, no, it was a really, really good show, I thought. I don't know how it compares to some of the other TakeOver specials lately. I thought it was a step below as far as in-ring action goes. The Revival and American Alpha had better tag team matches, I thought, than that one, if you're comparing it directly like that. But no, it was hard to find anything to complain for your $9.99 a month. And then, Sunday night, SummerSlam. 18 hours long. Might still be going on now as it is. Gotta say, these four-hour pay-per-views are killing me. I happened to have my wife and child out of town on Sunday, so I had the time dedicated to actually sit down and watch that whole thing. But good God, I wouldn't have the time to be able to sit down and watch these things if it wasn't for some, you know, agile time management on my part. And even the two-hour shows are a lot for me now, it seems like. And this was a killer. It wasn't a bad show, but God, it was a long show.
Yeah, that was a real thing. The length of it, you know, it's a whole weekend of wrestling, basically. And that's the last show. It's, you know, 7 hours long or whatever it is. And by that point, you know, the show had a big lull after Cena and AJ. And the crowd seemed a little... They seemed fed up at the end, I thought, especially after the non-finish in the Reigns-Rusev match. Oh, didn't match and even start, which I didn't mind, actually. But at that point in the show, it was a bad timing, especially with what was going to happen next. Lesnar and Orton. But yeah, that show I thought fell apart with Cena and AJ.
Yeah, especially it just seemed like really, really strange placement of the matches on that one. I thought the six woman match should have been in the death spot where Reigns and Rusev was. Like, really, like, if they're going to do that with Reigns and Rusev, especially if you're doing two TKO finishes in a row like that, it's kind of strange to do them bang bang like that. Like put the Rusev one, I guess, earlier on would be the way I'd go about it.
That's what I would have thought.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you have the lineup there handy? We can go through match by match if you want to. On the
yeah, I can pull it up in just 1 second.
Yeah, sure.
Did you see the pre-show matches at all?
No, unfortunately, I didn't. I watch typically on about a half hour delay, so usually I give myself some buffer time to if I need to rewind or pause anything like that. So I didn't. I watched a little bit of the pre-show itself on YouTube when it was streaming, but I didn't have the patience to sit through 2 hours of it and watch all the pre-show matches.
It was okay. I mean, the Cesaro-Sheamus match was pretty good. That was a really good match, I thought. Those two are very hard-hitting. Then you had the American Alpha, the Hype Bros, and the Usos. They beat Breezango, the Ascension, and the Vaudevillains. It was about a 15-minute match, actually. Wasn't bad. It was all action, at least.
Now, here's my question. I don't really watch the weekly TV, so I might not be up on the details of the storyline or something like that. I mean, it's something obvious, but Cesaro and Sheamus are having a best of seven series, right?
Correct.
What is the reasoning behind that, and what is up for grabs? I don't understand.
It's very odd. You know, shortly after the draft, Mick Foley went to both guys and said they can have a match, and whoever impressed them the most, we got a title shot. It was unspecified which title this would be. And then Cesaro won. They had a rematch because Foley was not impressed with either one of them. Cesaro won again. And then they interfered in each other's matches after that. And then Foley said that Cesaro proved himself and Sheamus proved himself. He got his head back in the game and decided to make a best of seven series. And the title shot might or might not be available at the end. Who knows?
Wow, this is compelling stuff. Compelling stuff.
Yeah, it's not the tightest storyline the company has going right now.
They couldn't even invent another title for it. I mean, they already got 17 of them. What's another one, right? be like the, you know, they would step below the Universal title, make it for the Galactic title or the Solar System title or something like that. You know?
Yeah, so that's the basis of that feud now. I guess the second match will happen next week on Raw.
Wow, I can speak for all of us when I say I can't wait to see what else they could pull out on their feud. How many different screwjob finishes can they work into this, I wonder? Because they can't just go 50-50 with each other, you know, doing a brogue kick and then a giant swing every week. So they're going to have to work in, you know, a distraction finish and DQ finish and a count-out finish just to mix it up a little bit. Maybe they'll even finish with a draw or a double count-out just to
throw it in. They could do that, too.
Have to have an eighth match, just like Booker T and Benoit did.
And the final match, the other match on the pre-show, was Sami Zayn and Neville. They teamed up to beat the Dudley Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And they tease more the tension between the Dudley Boys, who retired on Monday. So
yeah, that went nowhere, didn't it? Yeah, exactly. That's there's actually a lot of stuff that, in retrospect, went nowhere from SummerSlam to Raw, I have to say. Which is the same kind of thing that happened to WrestleMania, too, in fact. Now, I don't know about the difference. I think perhaps the Dudley Boys, they had been intending to do some kind of angle with them, and then I think things changed on Monday.
Yeah,
and they just decided to retire.
They actually, PW Insider, I guess, reported that they were going to sign an extension a couple months ago, and I guess over the past week they decided not to, and they retired.
Mm-hmm.
And they're legitimately gone from the company.
Is it retired or like just going back to TNA, I wonder?
Well, there was a thing online that someone saw and kind of seemed like Bubba was tweeting that he might be going back to TNA. I don't know. I didn't see it myself, so I can't comment on it too much. But they are no longer on a WWE contract, so they are free to go where they want.
Well, pretty good deal for them, I guess. They come in for a year, they make some money, and then they take off again. I think the Dudley Boys were it was just a huge amount of wasted potential that they were doing, though. It was clear from day one that, you know, Vince McMahon just saw them as the 2000 tag team, the guys with the glasses and the camo and the stuttering and everything like that. And it could have been a really interesting take on them. Kind of a, you know, the postmodern Dudley Boys with Bully Ray and everything like that. And which is really kind of funny as well, because like Vince was the one who repackaged them in 2002 in the first place. So you'd think he would have remembered that they could do something different. But as it turned out, they were guys who came in. They were reasonably hot for about a week last year, around the same time, actually, with the Brooklyn SummerSlam deal with the New Day and everything like that. And
yeah, they got a great reaction when they came back.
They got a great reaction for about a week, and then, yeah, just burned out, and that was it. And just done for the Dudley Boys. So too bad, but hey, great. Hopefully if they go back to TNA and probably feud with the Broken Hardy Boys again, that could also be pretty fun, I suppose.
And then we have the main show. And it kicked off with Enzo and Big Cass against Jericho, which is Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens.
I hate that name.
Yeah, it's a little corny. Some people like it, but I think it's a little corny.
I'm getting a little tired of the mashup names myself, but
I agree.
It's no Strike Force, I will say.
It does not.
No. The match was another head scratcher. Why are Enzo and Cass going out and jobbing in the first match in Brooklyn? Like, you'd think that would be a no-brainer, right? It's Enzo and Cass. They go out the opener in Brooklyn, they do their thing, they get the crowd hyped up, and they win. Especially against a team who aren't really a team. You know, it was this Jericho and Owens. It was the first time they were really teaming up. So I don't really understand that. It was a good match, I suppose. Kevin Owens steals the show, as usual, doing the Enzo dance on the apron and just being a general dick to everybody. Like, that was,
yeah, he was fantastic. And I guess with the ending of this match, they're going to continue the Jericho pairing. Otherwise, why the hell would you have them win? But they really do feed off each other well, I think, Jericho and Owens. They're great together.
It's a good theme. I guess if Owens isn't really going anywhere or doing anything as a single right now, you might as well throw him in a tag team with
Right. It's better
Jericho.
Than doing nothing.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought maybe the way they were going, it was going to be a tag team with him and Sami Zayn, because they had made the big deal about them being possibly split up in the draft, and then they weren't split up at all. They were on the same show, so that seemed to be telegraphing, oh, okay, well, then they're going to be a tag team. And then, as it turns out, no, they didn't do anything with them. So I'm, you know, confused, as always, by the way they're going with it.
And then if you saw Raw this past Monday, Owens won a match to go to the four-way next week to crown a new Universal Champion, and Jericho lost his match. So they teased some friction in a backstage interview segment during that show as well.
Oh, of course they tease friction. They've been teaming up for a day. I mean, God, that's like forever in WWE terms. Let's split them up. Why not? All right, so moving on.
So the next match was the women's championship match where Charlotte regained the title. She beat Sasha Banks for the title she lost about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Thought this was a pretty good match. It had some rough spots at the beginning.
Yeah, to say the least.
Some spot in the corner where Sasha almost became paralyzed. And they had some gory special. I don't know what they tried to do out of that. They screwed that up too. But, you know, they both worked hard.
I have no real complaints about the match. They did work hard. The spot out of the corner was just crazy. I don't know what they were shooting for there.
I also don't think that
doing a top rope splash mountain into a Hurricane Rana, that's not something that you should be asking them to do either. I don't know. I think Sasha maybe needs to tone it down a lot. Possibly, like somebody. I don't know if it's the agents who are, you know, going out there and telling her that she can be Jeff Hardy in 2009, or what it is. But like, yeah, she needs to slow it down a little bit.
Absolutely.
Save her career for a little longer.
Yeah, she does not protect herself well at all. She does a lot of crazy stuff. She's gonna regret it soon.
I know she loves Eddie Guerrero, but Eddie Guerrero didn't have a good end. So
no, he did not. So hopefully she's only going to miss a month or two, they are saying now. But this is her third or fourth injury in about the past year. She's banged up all the time, and the style she wrestles is going to keep happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when she's doing it as a baby face too, because she feels the pressure, I guess, to go out and do spectacular stuff for the fans, which is nice, but it's tough, especially in, I don't want to be sexist about it, but, the women have a slighter frame, and they're not as, they don't have all the steroided padding that the guys do to be able to take these crazy bumps out there. I mean, God, Sasha Banks weighs like 125 pounds, maybe, she's,
yeah.
It's not good to be going out there and diving off the apron night after night like that and, landing unprotected. It's just, that's a danger. But I thought it was a good match overall. I thought they worked it out at the end. And I was shocked at the finish. So that was, that was good because I was 100% expecting Sasha to retain in an easy match. And they went in a different direction with it. So good for them.
And after that, we had the Intercontinental title match, which saw The Miz retain against Apollo Crews.
Yeah.
Pretty short match, not even 6 minutes long. It was okay. You can tell that they don't have a whole lot of faith in Apollo Crews right now, I don't believe, to lose as cleanly and easily.
Yeah, no, that was really weird. I thought Apollo was like a guy that they were really high on, and maybe they brought him up too fast. Perish the thought, huh? But, we'll talk about The Miz, obviously, in a little bit as well, once we're done with
SummerSlam. Yes.
I wasn't even aware this match was happening. It's Apollo Crews. That's nice. And I actually thought, given that it was Apollo Crews and he was kind of the golden boy right now, that he would go out and win the title. But nope, he lost clean in the middle to the Skull Crushing finale. And that was that. It was not a good match or anything like that. But it is what it is. So yeah.
And after that, we had what was probably the match of the weekend when AJ Styles defeated John Cena in just an incredible match.
Yeah, that match was just it was crazy because it was, like a 20 it was like around like 28 minutes or whatever it was. And so they did like the 10 minutes of wrestling, right? They did basic kind of WWE main event stuff for the first 10 minutes or so, and then all of a sudden they start hitting finishers on each other, right? And AJ's doing the Styles Clash and Cena's doing the AA, and I was like, "Oh, damn, they're going to give him like 12 minutes here? Like what's going on? They're going to the finish already?" And then they just kept doing it for like another 15 minutes, and it was insane. And I thought it was great. Like it was just, I was like, "Well, they got to let up at some point," but nope, they didn't. They just kept going and doing all these crazy reversals, And John Cena doesn't get a lot of credit, I don't think. You know, especially for me, but you know, hey, I gotta say, like the whole bit where he does, he was hanging in there with AJ Styles.
He was
doing
the
reversals,
too.
You know, like going SDF into like the calf crusher, and then he would reverse into the AA and everything with that. And they totally had me with the top rope finisher. Like I was like, oh, Cena's going over, and nope, they did a kick out of two.
I thought that was a great spot because they had AJ elbowing him in the face, and he just sat there and took it like 10 elbows in the face, and still just grunted up and hit the move. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the end, but.
John Cena is a very talented professional wrestler. I don't think anybody can argue that point.
And he always brings it to the big shows.
Yeah, so people just stop booing the guy. Like, you know, boo Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns deserves it at least. But, you know, hey, John Cena's going out there and busting his ass, and he's not in the world title picture, and I can respect that. So.
And he got the standing ovation at the end, too.
Yeah, he got the standing O. He's off to shoot True Grit Season 2 or whatever he's off to do
American
right
Grit,
now.
I think it's called, yeah.
American Grit, whatever it is, yeah. Yep, and SmackDown loses another bit of star power. AJ obviously looks like he was elevated by that, to say the least. Looks like he's going to be going with Dean Ambrose for the world title next, so
yes,
fantastic, because that should be a title change.
Yes, and they presented AJ like a huge star on SmackDown, too, this week. They kept the momentum going. He was cocky. He was wearing Cena's headband at one point, making fun of Dolph Ziggler. Then he beat Ziggler in an amazing match. Great match. It's probably the best singles match in Ziggler's career. Oh. AJ's just in the zone right now as a worker. And
yeah, I really wish they hadn't split up the club now, too, with that, actually. I feel like I don't understand the point of the club being on Raw. And I feel like they could have kept the momentum going for AJ with him as his backups there on SmackDown, but I don't know.
Yeah, and the club is just floundering right now in Raw. They're in a terrible feud with the New Day.
Yeah. And, well, we'll discuss that in a bit, obviously, but yeah.
Yep. And that was the next match, which was before that we had Jon Stewart come out.
Yes.
What do you think of the Jon Stewart involvement in SummerSlam?
Well, you know, Stephanie had to cut the balls off somebody, and Jon Stewart was available, I guess, so that was the direction that they went with it. I thought it was a cute little self-aware thing from Jon Stewart, you know, where he's like, he was working the bit about, you know, oh, I won't make the mistake, you know, I promise not to hit anybody with a chair this year and all that stuff. You know, that was kind of funny, I guess.
Yeah, you know, he's a good sport about the stuff. He probably doesn't write the material either, so I can't blame him.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, the backstage segment with all the general managers and Jon Stewart and the New Day was just kind of the usual car wreck thing where everybody gets in there and does their catchphrases and leaves again, and it makes no sense. And yeah, it's just it's the way that they used to fill time, because God knows this show needed some time filler to go on it. Otherwise, it would have ran only 3 hours and 40 minutes, and God forbid. But yeah, the tag team title match was I don't know, I thought it was a bad match.
I did too. It's
you know, classified as like a TV match, but yeah, God, it was. Especially, you know, the finish of it with Jon Stewart running in, and there's no DQ on the referee, and nobody seems to care that he's in there, and just it went on and on, and yeah, it was ridiculous. It's just it's crazy to me what, you know, since the how far down the club have fallen since moving to Raw now as characters and workers in the ring, like that they don't have good matches anymore. And it's like, well, why did they bring them over at this point now?
Yeah, and this feud, it actually started off good. I thought they had the club come out on Raw and just destroy the New Day, destroy their props, sick of their jokes. And then the whole feud became a comedy feud with this ring post-itis gimmick. Are you aware of that? Where they?
Yeah, with the lemonade jars. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, with well, on our testicles now.
Yeah.
It's just a terrible feud.
Now,
it's
where's
awful.
Jerry Lawler to pay that off? You know, like that's they need a Jerry Lawler in commentary to talk about how he has experience with that. And they could, you know, play on that again.
Yeah, poor Jerry's relegated the pre-show or whatever he is now.
Mm-hmm. And the worst thing is that they're supposed to be doctors, and at no point do they make the joke where he says, "Oh, well, you can call me Doc Gallows." Like that's like the easiest one in the world to do, and they don't even do that one.
It's just right there in front of their face, and they still
right in front of their face. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, move it on.
So next we have the WWE World Championship match where Dean Ambrose defeated Dolph Ziggler. He retained the title. I thought this felt nothing like a championship match. This felt like a second or third match from the bottom of the card.
It was
painfully mediocre, I thought. And I thought Ambrose was terrible in this match, to be honest with you.
Harsh words.
What did you think of this match?
I don't think it was terrible. I thought it was an okay, like, TV match type of thing. I really don't know what to do with Dolph Ziggler from here on in. Like, he's kind of done as, you know, anything on the main event character
right
now at this point. Somebody was making a point that if he was on Raw instead of SmackDown, then they could do the thing where he sells out to the heel authority figures. But SmackDown is babyface authority figures, so you can't really sell out to them. So, yeah, it's kind of doesn't leave much there. I'm surprised Dean Ambrose looked so unmotivated just because he was winning. So you'd think he would be motivated to go out there and do something good. But, yeah, it just seemed like it was like two guys going out there, going through the motions. Dean was kind of healing a little bit on the crowd, which is really weird because you'd think Ziggler would be the one who would be more natural heel. I mean, it doesn't say right on his ass usually. It says heel on it, right? So that would seem to make more sense. So kind of the match was kind of lacking a lot of heat as a result of that, I thought. And, yeah, it was just kind of a really flat finish. Ziggler tries something, falls on his ass, and Dean hits him with the dirty deeds and pins him. So, yeah. But, like I say, hopefully there's light at the end of the tunnel and AJ Styles gets that title in a couple of weeks at the pay-per-view, because really how hot he is, they have to get the title onto AJ, because Dean's just not... I mean, they gave it a try with Dean. I give him credit for it, but I don't feel like Dean is just carrying it as a world champion level guy at this point.
And I don't either.
No fault to Dean's. Dean does what he does. They gave it a shot, but yeah, I just don't think it's working.
No, I don't think he brings it in the ring either for the quality of a match you need nowadays to be a champion.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing too, no one bought Ziggler as a challenger. They tried rehabilitating him in SmackDown, but it's only a month, and you're not going to do 2 years of unmotivated Dolph and him being buried, and it's no one bought him. And that played into it too. It's late in the show, and you see in this match, two guys look like they didn't really care, to be honest with you out there. The fans didn't really react much to this match.
Yeah. Well, I didn't react much at home either. I was doing other things. And
yeah, it was just tough to watch, actually. I watched it too late at night. I was kind of nodding off almost watching this match.
Yep, not good. All right, moving on.
So, we have the six-women match, I guess. Natalya, Alexa Bliss, and the returning Nikki Bella defeated Becky Lynch, Naomi, and Carmella. They got a lot of time in this match, and this is probably the worst match on the show.
Yeah, it was not a good match, yeah. Yeah, I was not a fan. Carmella is just painfully exposed.
Ooh, jeez. I don't know if you saw on SmackDown, she actually turned heel, thank the Lord.
Well, that's better at least then. I will say she's better as a heel than as a babyface.
It was quite possibly the worst babyface act I've ever seen. I don't know why you'd ever chair someone like that, and she wasn't getting chaired whatsoever at any point.
The problem is that she was never really a babyface as such. What it was is she came along as part of the Enzo and heel package in NXT, and when they turned babyface, then she was kind of turned with them.
Right, they probably figured... crowd like her too.
Yeah, exactly. And it turns out that no, the crowd doesn't care about Carmella and the Enzo and Cass with the whole package. That being said, I think they should have brought Carmella up with Enzo and Cass, because you know it's always good to have a pretty blonde in the corner, you know, working up the crowd and stuff like that, and it would have worked with the deal. But as just bringing it up by itself, it was bad idea. Bad idea to bring Alexa Bliss up at this point. Alexa's just not there as a wrestler yet. I mean, she was doing fine in NXT, learning to be a wrestler, and the gimmick with, you know, her managing her boys was a good step as well. But she's obviously a very small fish in a very big pond on SmackDown. And she was another one where just she looked like somebody who's completely lost out there in the match. And really, when you got a couple of people on the same team who look lost like that, it's recipe for disaster, especially when you have, you know, somebody like Naomi is the one who has to try to carry things, and just bad stuff. And Nikki Bella out there, who's just back from a neck injury, and who looks like somebody from a totally different era, frankly. Like, they went through all this thing with the Divas Revolution, and now it's back to Nikki Bella as, you know, top star again. Like, come on. That's kind of silly.
Yeah, and she's going to be a face now, which makes sense, actually. She came off a pretty major neck injury. In question, she even should be wrestling at this point. But Carmella attacked her on SmackDown and again on Talking Smack on the network after the show ended. So they're going to go with that feud, I guess, for now.
Double turn.
Yep.
Which makes me question why they would bring out Nikki as a heel in the first place. Then why not just bring her out as a babyface? Because then she would get a big babyface reaction for her return. And there you go. You're right where you want to be. Instead of having to go through the convoluted thing of bringing her out as a heel and then having to turn somebody else on her to make her a babyface. I don't understand. At any rate, I don't even remember what the finish was. It was Nikki Bella pinning Carmella, I think, wasn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I forget too, actually.
Yeah, no, there you go. That's shows you how memorable that match was.
Left a lasting impression on both of us.
Exactly. All right, moving on to the next match.
So, well, first, they displayed for the first time the WWE Universal Championship belt.
Oh, that poor belt. People hurt Seth Rollins' feelings too.
It did, and that was one ugly belt.
That was one. It wasn't ugly so much as it was misguided. I think it's just if they brought it out sooner, like if they had introduced it on Raw a couple of weeks so people get used to it, rather than building up as this big mysterious thing and then unveiling it 3 seconds before the match, and it's like, hey, guess what? It's the same thing except with, you know, Shinsuke Nakamura's pants on it. Then I think it would have been less of an eyesore for people, but. Just the way they did it, like, just how lazy can you get, right? Like, not even a new design or anything. They're just, and I same thing on SmackDown, I guess, too. From what I saw, it looks like they're just, the women's title is just the same thing as the one from Raw, but in blue. And the tag team titles are, instead of, you know, copper penny bronze, they're silver instead. So, like, just, I know they're all into the branding and everything like that, but Jesus, like, could sell more belts if they're, to kids, if the, you know, you can make replicas that look unique and cool rather than the same thing over and over again with different strap things, like it's Ultimate Warrior changing belts or something like that.
Absolutely. And what do you think about the chanting that went on during this match about that belt? These fans were not letting this belt go. They were holding on to that. That was their crossed.
It was really weird because I was disappointed in the belt, but I wasn't as angry about it as these people seem to be. I don't understand the super hostility from Brooklyn towards that belt like that. Like, I was feeling bad for the belt after a while.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, the belt looked like shit. After 5 seconds, I got over. I wanted to see the match. I don't really need to harp on it that long.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, the problem, too, I guess, well, a little bit, was that the match didn't really, like, take off into the stratosphere for about the first 10 or 15 minutes. You know, it was a good match for the most part, but it took a little while for them to really hit the groove and get into it like that. So I can see how maybe the fans were a little, you know, a little bored of the match
right to
start out with there. But I mean, it turned into a hell of a match. Like, you know,
it did.
You know, another shocking statement, Finn Balor and Seth Rollins are both excellent professional wrestlers. So, you know, amazingly, they had a good match together. Aside from one spot, of course.
And I watched that match again. And just watching Balor work after taking that powerbomb spot, which tore his labrum, he was working with one arm out there, and to his credit, he did a great job.
Yeah, apparently what happened was he took the powerbomb into the railing and it popped his shoulder out of the socket. And then he went off camera, popped it back in, and then continued the match. But when he popped it back in, I guess that's when he tore his labrum. So, you know, good on him for guts, but Jesus.
That's a painful injury.
I know. It's like he's like Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon 2 or something like that. Like, popping that thing in and out, but at least it's not as bad as Randy Orton yet, but you know, it's, that was, well, I guess we'll talk about Seth Rollins a little bit as well, but he's got to stop doing that move. But it was a good match overall, I thought, and glad to see that they did the logical thing and put Finn Balor over clean in his first match as the Demon King. Because really, you had to, because again, you could, I'm all for Seth Rollins being the champion, but you could put it on him later. Like, you got all the time in the world with Seth Rollins, but you only had one chance to make that impression with Finn Balor like that. So I'm glad that they pulled the trigger in the first match, even though he got injured.
And then after that, we had what was scheduled to be Roman Reigns versus Rusev for the United States Championship. That match never took place. They had a brawl that ended with Roman Reigns going nuts and attacking the ribs of Rusev. I thought it was a decent segment, actually. However, at this point of the show,
it was decent,
it was
but
bad
not,
placement.
Yeah, not this long into an already long pay per view. There's actually a sign in the crowd that said this pay per view is long, which truer words than ever been spoken. But yeah, that was the kind of thing. It was really weird because they had the clean finish on Raw beforehand, and then they built up to the brawl on the pay per view where there was no finish. So that was kind of weird. Poor Rusev though, like I don't understand the booking with him at all. Like the guy, he goes out there with his new wife in a wedding dress, and she gets shoved through a wedding cake. So he's standing up to this bully Roman Reigns, who's going after his woman, and he's supposed to be the bad guy. And then he gets his ass beat by Roman, and who, by the way, still hasn't got the U.S. title match that he was promised. So he basically screwed himself out of the U.S. title and looks kind of dumb on that one too. So it was a really strange thing. I the explanation I've heard is that they didn't want to have Roman be the U.S. champion, which is like, okay, well then why did you book the match? Why not just book it as a non-title match, right? You know, it's easy enough to get around that. So I don't know. It seemed like it was a fun thing. Roman Reigns was showing kind of promise of not being booed out of the building every night in this Rusev thing, but he was booed out of the building in Brooklyn and obviously the next day on Raw. So I don't know how successful it was.
Yeah, and like you said with the Rusev booking, I don't know if you saw Raw this past Monday. He faced Cass in a match that the winner would go to the Fatal 4-Way for the title. That match ended when Rusev, whose ribs were all taped up, he was getting his ribs targeted the whole match. He rolled out of the ring, and he walked up the ramp and got counted out. And that's a heel doing that.
Yeah, I don't get it. But Rusev is awesome, though. We've talked about it a million times. But,
oh, he's great.
He's great. Yeah. So I hope they continue to do good things with him. Maybe he'll beat the winner of the Sheamus Cesaro Best of 7 series, possibly to continue his dominance. Who knows? As long as they don't put the Universal title on Reigns next week on Raw. I don't know if we can talk about it, but I think it will be. I think Rollins will finally get that title next week. I think it was obvious. It was going to Rollins at some point, probably on the next pay-per-view anyway, so they might as well just do it now and put it on it. He's the biggest star that they have, basically, on the show at this point, so you might as well, unless they do something wacky like Big Cass, but I just don't see it. I think it's time to put the belt on Rollins, let him run with it. Hopefully he doesn't injure anybody.
And now,
that main event.
The main event.
Yes.
Brock Lesnar defeated Randy Orton by technical knockout.
It was a weird match.
It really was. For those that haven't seen the match, Lesnar just started elbowing Orton repeatedly in the head, and Orton was busted open and just pouring out blood. Absolutely pouring out blood.
I was pretty horrified. I will say, as somebody who has a 6-year-old daughter, I would not have been happy had she wandered into the room while I was watching that match. It's a show that's marketed towards basically kids. Like they're trying to attract all these kids in the audience, and Brock Lesnar gets a free pass to do this kind of stuff. And if my daughter came in and saw somebody be bashed in the head with elbows until they started gushing blood all over the mat like that, I would have turned the show off. Like, that's not good. I don't really appreciate when they do that kind of thing, I have to say. Especially because they got rid of blading because it was supposed to be barbaric. So it's like, okay, so we'll get rid of blading because it's barbaric, but here we'll have this 300-pound guy bash his elbows into another person's skull until it bleeds all over the mat. So that's apparently an improvement, I guess. But it's okay.
Yeah. And what did you think of the match overall?
Again, it was weird because they're trying to do the standard Brock Lesnar suplex city match, but Orton either couldn't or wouldn't go up for most of the suplexes. So it looked like Brock having a muscle Orton over for all these suplexes over and over again. And I don't know, for me, the formula is kind of wearing thin with Brock now at this point with those ones. Like, I mean, you know, you can only do so many German suplexes in a row before you want to see something out of them. And like Dean Ambrose was saying, you know, the same kind of thing on the podcast, where basically he came up with all these cool ideas for a match to do with Brock at WrestleMania. And Brock was like, you know, no, screw that. We're going suplex, suplex, suplex. And, you know, you can like it. So, I mean, you know, obviously Brock gets away with a lot of stuff that other people don't, but it's like, I don't know. I feel like the shine is kind of off Brock Lesnar as the, with these special attraction matches. And he really needs to do something different or change it up or something like that. Cause yeah, it's just kind of silly now.
I agree. And I don't know where you go with him from here. They didn't really follow up on this much on Raw. They had, or SmackDown. We found out that Stephanie fined him $500.
$500. That's right. So,
and it seems like they might actually be going for a Lesnar versus Shane confrontation down the road.
God, I hope not. Ugh. You could kind of sort of buy Undertaker versus Shane in a way in the Hell in a Cell thing with everything stacked against Undertaker, I guess. But like, God, if you have to go in there and somehow accept that Shane McMahon is going to survive a beating for Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania, like that's just over the top. There was another suggestion that maybe Shane might, you know, bring in Samoa Joe as a hired gun or something along those lines. And I'd be kind of okay with that, I think. But God, yeah, I hope that's not their idea, because like I think they feel like they need to have, it has to be, you know, the big marquee thing every time that they use Brock. And Shane's like, you know, they're one of their marquee guys. So I think that might be where their head's at with it. But yeah, I don't know where else you go with Brock from there. Like, don't want to really do Undertaker again. Like that's kind of played out, I think, that feud. And I don't know who else is left as a big star. I guess you can do The Rock, but there might be other things with him up, which we'll talk about in a bit as well. So I don't know, choices are kind of limited. I think Samoa Joe is the best bet, but might be Shane.
I think Joe would be a great match. However, I don't know if they'll see Joe in that light, that he can go up against Lesnar like that. That's, you know, that's a slot for like main event people. I don't know if they're going to put him as a main event guy right away. I really don't see that happening. I think it's going to end ultimately with Reigns, Lesnar again at 33, WrestleMania 33. I think they're going to get there some way. And that's the end game.
Not the worst idea, I guess. They got to do something with Reigns, I guess. Right. But yeah, that's, at this point, I think they're going to do that. Then they should just put Reigns over. Because it's, you know, it was getting to the point like with the Undertaker streak where, you know, what's the end game, right? Same thing with Brock. They haven't beaten him in forever. And it doesn't seem like there's an end game coming up. It's just Suplex City, beating on guys, smashing people open with elbows and wreaking havoc. And it's like at some point, you got to have a resolution to the storyline. And I don't know what that's going to be. But yeah, I hope, you know, hey, if Reigns wins, then great. But I don't know. I think it might even be a waste of Brock at that point. I think, you know, you really need somebody new from NXT, like to, and I don't know who that would be. Well, I don't know if they have anybody coming up who's going to be at that level, but you got to bring in somebody who you want to push to the top right away and just bring him in and put him over Brock at WrestleMania and be done with it.
I think it might end with someone. We might actually get Lesnar versus Shane at some point, and someone runs out, saves Shane, and they're the face, and they face Lesnar after that. It could be Reigns. It could be anybody. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's how we see it play out with an actual Lesnar versus Shane match.
Well, there's all kinds of bad ideas they can do, I guess, and we'll see how they go with it.
Oh, there are tons of bad ideas they can do.
There's tons of bad ideas. So speaking of Brock, I guess we'll discuss this before we hit a break and do some news. So after, I guess, SummerSlam, in the backstage area, there was Chris Jericho got into a backstage confrontation with Brock Lesnar. Brock apparently being his usual charming self. Chris Jericho, I guess, went to the gorilla position to ask what the finish of the match was supposed to be because he was concerned about Randy Orton's well-being. And Michael Hayes kind of stonewalled him. Wouldn't tell him what was going on. And so Jericho was getting upset about it, saying, oh, this is bullshit. And then Brock came in and thought that Jericho was talking about the finish of the match being bullshit. And basically dared him for a fight, and tempers flared. So, I don't know. Who would you be picking, Jericho or Lesnar in that situation?
I think I agree with Jericho in that situation. And, you know, Lesnar can't be a popular guy in the locker room right now. Part-time guy, does what he wants. Failed drug test in the UFC, doesn't apply to him in the WWE. And I think a lot of guys work full-time. You know, they get screwed over working there full-time.
Oh, yeah, they sure do. Well, I mean, Jericho's only a part-timer himself as well, so he gets some of the same perks that Lesnar does. But I don't know, the kind of the thing where they're not giving away the finish to the Lesnar match because they want it to be a big secret. It's, you know, it's not quite to WCW levels of, you know, working the boys or whatever, but like it's still kind of douchey on their part. I mean, like, you know, you go out there and watching Orton get his head bashed open. Of course, somebody like Jericho is going to be concerned for his safety and well-being and everything like that, especially because, you know, bleeding has been banned for so long.
Right.
From the promotion, right? Like, it's...
You can imagine, too, you can imagine he was the only one thinking that backstage as well. He's probably the one who spoke up about it, but he can't be the only one thinking that backstage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, I don't know, just bad on everybody's part, I think, with you know, the way they're handling this Lesnar thing. Like, they really, they need to do something to get him under control, I think. Could be, who knows, could all be an angle, I don't know, but really, it starts to leave a bad taste when clearly somebody's being favored so much like Brock is, and I don't even know at this point what he's bringing to the product. Like, he doesn't really draw TV ratings anymore. Pay-per-view obviously is meaningless now at this point. Shows sell out on a WWE name rather than Brock, so like, what are they paying millions of dollars for to have Brock around? I don't know. If they don't have an end game, it's hard to say.
He has the same feuds, the same promos from Paul Heyman. It's the same thing every time now.
Yep. All right. So with that, I think we're going to go halfway here, point here. So we're going to take a quick break, come back, and discuss a whole bunch of news that's going on here for the past couple of days.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcasts. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzuto here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's Past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners, as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network. where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
You think you know me?
All right, we are back on the Podcast of Doom. I'm your host, Scott Keith, along with Brian Bayless. And thanks for checking out our new show. You can find the Podcast of Doom at placetobenation.com and by subscribing to the Place to Be podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. This show shares a podcast feed with other great programs like the aforementioned Place to Be podcast, Clotheslines and Headlines, PTBN's Main Event, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. You can learn more about all these programs at placetobenation.com or by clicking on the podcast logo on the right side. In addition, there are a number of regular written series going on, including Brian's Raw and SmackDown reviews, Justin and Scott's Vintage Vault refreshes, and PTBN's excellent network adventure. Also, don't forget to check out the PWO, PTBN Podcast Network, for hardcore wrestling shows like Between the Sheets, Exile on Bad Street, Where the Bad Boys Play, This Week in Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, At the Garden, and the Titans of Wrestling. And hey, there's more than just wrestling at Place to Be Nation. Be sure to check out PTBN Pop for comics and pop culture audio, and check back daily for cool features on the site, like our Seinfeld rewatch, comics reviews, Wednesday walk around the web, and more. So thanks always to Place to Be Nation for hosting the Podcast of Doom. And of course, check out blogofdoom.com for all of my stuff and Brian's stuff, including my daily Wrestling Observer flashback posts that I do around this. We're up to the 1988 now, the beginning part there with Bunkhouse Stampede, the first Royal Rumble, and coming up on the first main event on NBC, which is kind of a cool time. And actually, since we just passed Starrcade 87, a little bit later on here, we will be doing a flashback rant on Starrcade 87 here on the show. All right, so all kinds of stuff going on here right now, Brian, in the follow-up from SummerSlam. Leading off, the Talking Smack segment after SmackDown on WWE Network with The Miz cutting a crazed promo on Daniel Bryan, which was kind of awesome, I thought. It's kind of a weird thing. I mean, obviously Daniel Bryan's not going to be getting back into the ring to wrestle him anymore, so I'm not really sure where they're going with it, but it was quite the impassioned promo from Miz, I thought. It was kind of one of the better things that I've heard from him for quite a long time. He's a guy who hasn't really seemed to, you know, have really much passion for what he's been doing since losing the world title a couple of years ago. And just hearing him going off on Daniel Bryan about how he never gets injured and he's been around for all these years, match after match, doing whatever they want. And, you know, if Daniel Bryan really wanted to, he could quit the company and go work bingo halls again, which is actually, he makes a good point. Like, nothing's stopping Daniel Bryan from, you know, I guess leaving when his contract expires, but he would have to sit it out. So what do you think about Miz's tirade?
Oh, I thought it was excellent. That was probably a 5-star promo, pretty much.
5-star promo. All right.
I thought it was great. I thought it was great. And really, it goes to show you that you let these guys just speak off the mind and not some, you know, script written by the guy who wrote House Party 12 or whatever. These guys can do some great work on their own. Miz was phenomenal here. You know, what he said was true for the most part. I think he's underutilized on SmackDown. His act at Maurice, they're great together. They really are. It's a very unique heel act. And I forgot who mentioned it on the PBTN reaction show, but usually the heel is yelling and talking down to their woman. But these two are so together and on the same page and love each other, and they're heel that way. It's unique. And on a show with very little star power, very little depth, you know, build him up as a heel act and then have a babyface come in and beat him. They can get really over from that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Except, of course, that hasn't happened. Miz has been champion for about, you know, since WrestleMania for months and months now. And I have no idea where they're going with it.
But, and he's been both like a booked like a total joke on SmackDown. So it's really, they're really wasting him on that show.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting dynamic too. Miz being the guy who's like, who thinks he's a celebrity, but you know they both vastly overestimate their own celebrity worth, that sort of thing. And especially because it seems like they're willing to laugh at themselves a little bit by pointing out how terrible that these WWE films, movies that they do, really are. When normally they'd be putting them over as, you know, oh, it's, you know, you know, the Marine Six is, you know, it's like a crazy good movie from WWE Studios. So it's kind of an interesting twist on it, where they're basically, you know, deprecating themselves, which is, it's kind of in the same way, it's kind of a dumb thing to do, but like, yeah, it's really a neat character that Miz was doing. And like I say, it's really, really neat to see him get all fired up. Obviously he's always had really good chemistry with Daniel Bryan. I mean, that was that was his first feud when Bryan was coming into WWE, and they worked well together. So I guess they're playing off that a little bit, but you know, it's the best stuff always comes from real things. And you know, you could tell Daniel Bryan is still really, really kind of sore and bitter about being forced into retirement like that and not being good. And, you know, Miz makes a good point. Like, he did, Daniel Bryan promised to be back in a year and get that title back, and he never did. So, yeah, it was really effective. Segment. Like I said, I don't know where it's going, but I'm glad to finally see them giving Miz something to sink his teeth into instead of, you know, doing the same thing week after week.
Yeah, it was a great segment. It got a lot of buzz. A lot of buzz. People are still buzzing about it now today, even. When it happened last night, everybody was raving about it.
Yeah, and I did think it was funny because somebody tipped me off to it, and I went to go post it, and I saw that you had already posted it onto the website. So that was kind of cool there, I thought.
Yeah, because I work late Tuesday night, so I actually, not supposed to, but I reviewed SmackDown at work last night, and I came home and touched it up. And then I watched the, 2 a.m. I finished it, and I just posted the video. Because everybody should see that interview if they haven't already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just watched it again here before the show, too. And, it was really fantastic. And the other nice thing, too, with it is that it's kind of unique as well today. Because you don't really get that kind of ranting and raving, yelling heel promo anymore at a lot of guys. Like, that's really, it felt like a real, like, throwback to the 80s kind of thing with Miz, you know, doing everything short of, you know, yelling and pointing at the camera, like the old heels and Crockett used to do. And, right. You know, Renee Young being like, you know, oh, you know, you got to calm down. Like, you know.
Yeah, she was great, too, in that scene. I thought she was great, too, there. She reacted well to everything. It was a great segment all around.
Yeah, no, it's really good stuff. I just wish that it could, you know, something a little bit more obvious as far as the payoff goes. But, I mean, I guess you could have Daniel Bryan bring in guys to be his, you know, his like knights in shining armor to save him or something like that. I don't know. No, it was really good stuff. Okay. Next up, Seth Rollins, of course, injuring Finn Balor in the powerbomb spot. So right on cue, Bret Hart has decided to, spring forward with more criticism of Seth Rollins, reminding us once again that, he wrestled for 23 years, and not once did he ever hurt one opponent, ever.
And I'm going to cut you off because I review many shoot interviews on the Blog of Doom, and one Barry Horowitz, in his interview, said during the 93 Survivor Series, when he was the Red Knight, Bret Hart kicked him in the head and concussed him.
What?
So Bret's claim is false, according to Barry Horowitz.
Shocking breaking news here on the Podcast of Doom.
That's right.
Now, I wonder if there was some bitterness on Bret's part, because Barry Horowitz used to wrestle as Bret Hart. So maybe there was some simmering resentment there. That was, you know, so there's something else going on there. Who knows?
I'm going to set him straight.
Yeah, exactly. Be like, hey, I'm the only Bret Hart that's here. Bret's statement for WrestleZone said that he said he takes no great pleasure in saying "I told you so," which is funny because I think he does take pleasure in saying "I told you so" several times.
I do too.
But he says, if you're a professional wrestler and you keep hurting opponents and or yourself, clearly you're doing it wrong. I wrestled a very realistic and physical style, and not once in 23 years did I ever hurt one opponent. Seth Rollins needs to improve his technique and become the safest wrestler in the business. I think that's Miz, isn't it? I don't know. I have great respect for Seth. I believe he'll improve and hopefully stop hurting the talent before someone gets killed. Wrestlers have to trust one another If the wrestler holds the life of another wrestler in his hands for the sake of his family, wife, or children, you plain and simply cannot drop it. So, yeah, I don't know if it's that bad. But, I mean, obviously Seth Rollins is, you know, I think it's mostly that powerbomb spot that that's really the main thing with Seth. There was the knees to John Cena's face, but that seems like more of a one-off fluke than anything else. I don't think that's indicative of any kind of long-term problem with Seth and Muay Thai knees or anything like that. But, I mean, I kind of see where Brett's coming from with that, but I think he's kind of overstating it and using it to, you know, play up his own 23-year safety record for whatever reason.
Right.
And, you know, Brett's just going to, you know, Brett's just going to be Brett. And I think Seth probably could do with retiring the powerbomb, but I don't think that people are, you know, cowering in fear in the back of working with Seth Rollins or anything like that at this point.
Right, and you know, Finn took the spot willingly. I'm assuming. It's a tough spot. You do anything, even wrestling, a body slam can hurt on. Anything can hurt you.
Flinging your 200, you know, some pound frame into a metal railing is something that is going to come with some risks inherent, no matter what you're doing. Further, though, Brett said that. Of course, he brought up Bill Goldberg again, and then he said, "When I think of Samoa Joe nearly killing Tyson Kidd and see him continue to use that deadly finish of his, I just shake my head." Which is, Samoa Joe's been doing the Muscle Buster for, you know, how many years now? Like, close to 20 years. It seems like it was a fluke. It happens. Tyson's kid neck was in really bad shape to begin with, apparently. And while the Muscle Buster might have been something that, you know, was the final straw on it, like, he was going to hurt himself no matter what, just from the style that he worked like that. And, you know, again, I could, you know, obviously, Brett's going to stick up for his brother-in-law or whatever relation they are to each other at this point now. But again, I think he's very out of touch with the business now at this point, unfortunately. He's kind of turning into Bill Watts a little bit. And it's really kind of crazy. I think that, you know, had Brett stayed with the 20-year deal originally in 1997, he'd be in a pretty high-end, high-office, front-office position right now with WWE. And who knows how things would shake down at that point then.
Right.
All right, so moving on. Well, Brock Lesnar did not suffer any consequences from WWE over the drug failure. He was apparently facing a two-year sentencing from USADA over his drug failure earlier. He got a little bit of good news, though, earlier today that both him, actually, and John Jones are probably only going to be facing a one-year penalty, mostly because he got caught with the anti-estrogen. It's a clomiphene, I think it's called. It's the substance is actually classified as something that there is reasonable explanations for having it in your system. So it might not necessarily be something where you're deliberately doping yourself. So basically, there's enough reasonable doubt involved with the substance that it won't be an automatic two-year suspension. However, it'll probably be a year suspension. So he'll probably be sticking around WWE for a while and not fighting. But, you know, at least there's some consequences for Brock, I guess, out of this.
Yeah. Now, Lesnar's contract at WWE ends in 2018, correct? It's not next year, it's the year afterwards?
Right, yeah.
Okay. So I guess my question is, do you see Lesnar fighting again in UFC?
Possibly. I mean, a year is not a killer. Like, 2 years would have pretty much done it for him, I think. But I mean, like, you know, 1 year is like, starts training again in about 6 months and builds up to a fight. I think he can do it again. I don't know if they'll trust him to be in another high profile fight like the Mark Hunt one was. But yeah, I think actually, assuming he doesn't hurt himself with his high impact style in WWE where he's doing all that stuff, then I think he'd be, probably be okay for a fight. I think we'll probably see him again, but you know, I don't know if Dana White's gonna trust him in that kind of high profile position. That was the only thing that I would really worry about. And moving on, ratings. SmackDown actually did really good again on Tuesday. They're only dropping about it's like 15%, I think, from Raw's audience, which is pretty much a damn near a miracle considering where the show was at even just a couple months ago on Thursday and Friday at USA.
Yeah, I think they were up 10% last night.
Yeah.
And it was actually a really good show. It was a really good show top to bottom. Solid wrestling show. Two really good matches in the final hour. Ziggler and AJ had a great match, but also Breezango and American Alpha had a very good match as well themselves. Was part of
that. Do you think American Alpha is going to get the tag team titles, or are they going to put them on the Usos and have American Alpha chase them for a little while?
I think Usos going to turn at some point in this tournament. They could have them turn to win, cheat to beat Alpha to win the titles, or they could turn after losing to them. But I think the ultimate goal out of this is have the Usos and Alpha feud.
Yeah, I mean, they're the only two real big star teams on the brand, so I mean, it would make sense to do that.
And then they added a secondary angle on the show. They had Heath Slater, who was told if he found a partner and they won the tournament, he can get a contract with SmackDown. And so he'll be teaming with Rhino next week to face an unnamed team. I don't think they'll have them win it. They'll probably just continue the storyline that Slater's a free agent. But I think Alpha and the Usos are going to be the first real SmackDown tag team feud.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know about Rhino as the payoff for this Heath Slater thing.
No, I don't think it's going to be it.
I don't know. Crazy as it sounds, I think they might have something with Heath Slater in this. Because, you know, fans are chanting for him now. Like, this free agent bit, like, you know, they're kind of in their own ass backwards way. They're getting over a little bit. And
right.
I don't know. I think they should. You would think they'd have something a little bit better planned for like the payoff of his free agent run here, like that. Like, I don't know. Like,
I think they can get a great reaction if he wins a match. Once he finally gets a contract and wins, that plays like a nuts for him, I think.
Yeah, he'd bring in like Rob Van Dam or something like that to be his partner. You know, something where they got I don't know, like who's you know who else may be floating around out there? Maybe you know one of the Hardy Boys if they're. If their contract is up in TNA.
Yeah, get Brother Nero in there.
Get Brother Nero, yes. Exactly. As long as he's not broken.
That's right.
You gotta make sure he's put in through testing to make sure he's unbroken before they sign him to a WWE contract. Make sure he's been undeleted, I guess. Speaking of these work shoot feuds here that we're going over this week, apparently Vin Diesel and The Rock don't like each other. But it might actually be building up towards a WrestleMania match of some kind. I don't know. I don't know. I guess Vin Diesel versus The Rock at WrestleMania couldn't be any more of a waste of time than what The Rock did last year. But I don't know about this. Like trying to use this to build up the Fast and the Furious movie just seems kind of beneath WWE at this point. I have to say, I know. Strange as that sounds, I think, you know, they're kind of the point where when these kind of silly Hollywood feud things are kind of below them, actually.
Yeah, I don't think this match will ever happen. If anything, maybe an angle on the show at most, but I don't know. I don't think this is happening.
Well, you know, Uproxx says it is, so who knows? An insider, they say. They have word from an insider that this so-called feud is absolutely 100% related to WrestleMania 33. It's all for publicity. So, I don't know about a match. I don't know if Vin Diesel could get insurance to do it, even if he wanted to like that. But I don't know. It's maybe they'll like team up and drive cars through the stadium or something like that. Who knows? But I don't know why they're bothering bringing in Rock for stuff like he did last year with the flamethrower and the Wyatts and everything like that. Just more overstuffed stuff.
Yeah, that was so grandiose, the flamethrower act. That was terrible.
Yes. All right, so any other news bits that I missed here this week that you can think of there, or should we move on to Starrcade 87?
I think we covered it all. I'm trying to think of anything else I heard. Nothing else really worth discussing, I don't think.
All right, on to the flashback rant portion of this program. Now, as I was mentioning, I do the Wrestling Observer flashbacks every day on the blog, or you know, as close to every day as I can. And recently we passed through Starrcade 87, Chi-Town Heat, Glory Bound, a show so big that it needed two subtitles. So might as well go over the history of this one a little bit. before we get into it. So, of course, as everybody knows, there's a thing called the Survivor Series that WWE has been doing for, you know, a billion years now. But back in 1987, Jim Crockett Promotions and the NWA used to run Starrcade every Thanksgiving. It was their big tradition. And so at that point, around November, they decided they wanted to break into the pay-per-view market because WWE had made $1.5 million off WrestleMania 3 on pay-per-view. And Jim Crockett saw that money and thought that he could get a piece of it as well. So shortly after they announced the show, lo and behold, WWE announces their own pay-per-view, the Survivor Series 87, running at the same time, this Crockett show. And it was kind of all downhill from there for them. The show was originally supposed to be in Greensboro or Charlotte or one of the Crockett territories there, and they moved it to Chicago early on into the process, which proved to be a huge mistake. They lost tons of money on the live gate alone on that one for error number one. Error number two, then they blinked and actually moved the show back into the afternoon, which proved to be downright suicidal for them. They were trying to avoid the WWF's Survivor Series show, and it didn't work at all. They assumed that cable companies would side with them over WWF, and that proved not to be true as well. They ended up losing pretty much all of their cable systems. The show ended up only being available in something like 300,000 homes, some very minuscule number compared to the 6 or 7 million that Survivor Series was available in. They were counting on cable companies to offer it as a 2-for-1 proposition, but Vince put the kibosh on that. And in fact, threatened to drop any cable companies that offered that, so that didn't happen either. And then, of course, most damning of all, they put the world title on Ronnie Garvin leading up to the show as the big angle so Flair could regain it there. And in fact, their ratings in the syndicated packages ended up dropping out of the top 15 completely as a direct result of that. It was astonishingly bad decision-making on everybody's part around the show. Not necessarily one of the worst pay-per-views of all time, but certainly one of the most ill-fated, I'd say, overall. So, yeah, so it was not a good first attempt at the pay-per-view market for Jim Crockett, I would say.
No, I think Jim Cornette at one point said that, because I ran this paper against Chicago, the people of Greensboro never really forgot Crockett and kind of killed the city a little bit for them.
Yeah, Crockett killed a lot of cities in around this time, unfortunately.
Yeah, he did.
It's kind of something he was specializing in.
And buying the UWF was a terrible move.
Oh, well, we can talk about that.
Yeah,
he had a lot of terrible moves. Yeah, that's a whole other show. Yeah, buying the UWF was a terrible move. Buying Central States, buying Florida, moving everything to Dallas. We'll get into the UWF thing during this show here because it's one of the storylines that factors into it. But all right, so the show is from Chicago, Illinois, of course, hosted by Tony Schiavone and Jim Ross. So we start out with a 6-man tag team match. Eddie Gilbert, Larry Zbyszko, and Rick Steiner taking on Sting, Jimmy Garvin, and Michael Hayes. Garvin and Hayes were actually being transitioned into a regular tag team at that point. Not the regular tag team that became about a year later as the Freebirds, but they were being turned into basically a babyface tag team coming out of the UWF. And actually a lot of this was based out of the UWF. Sting was not really Sting. He was, again, kind of an up-and-comer coming out of the UWF who was considered a reclamation project by Jim Crockett. And he quickly became a huge star. But at this point, he was still kind of a tag team guy. He had been teaming up with Sting and Eddie with Rick Steiner and Eddie Gilbert as part of that tag team. And he was quickly improving at that point.
Yeah, he just came off a turn, correct? And he just turned babyface?
Exactly, yeah. They had done a breakup angle with him and Steiner. And Sting had split away on his own, and he was kind of the one of the hot prospects that they were bringing in from the UWF. And, as it turned out, they got, as far as the UWF sale goes, they got Sting out of it, and that more than justified any other money that they wasted on him, I have to say. So they were kind of ahead of the game just from having him there. It was kind of a dull opener, especially for something like a Starrcade like that. You want to bring something in there, have a lot of big action to start out with the NWA name, because this was supposed to be their introduction on pay-per-view. Like, this was the first time that people were supposed to be able to see them on there, and they kind of did the first problem was that the arena was kind of empty at that point. People were people were not all the way filling it up, so you kind of have an empty arena. Yeah, it was kind of a dull match. It was mostly, Larry Zbysko in there stalling, and Michael Hayes being a clown, and nothing really great there. And it ended up being like a 15-minute draw. It was, it was an okay match. It was like a 2-star match. It was nothing terrible, but it was really not a really hot introduction for the NWA on pay-per-view. It was just kind of something that was there, and not the worst match in the show by any means, but I felt it was a kind of a huge disappointment overall.
I thought it was a little bit better than you did, but the finish, I mean, you want to kick off a pay-per-view in a big market and you do a 15-minute draw and a 6-man to start the show. That's not the way I'd go. And the crowd was pretty psyched to start on the show. I just having a babyface team was common sense at that point. I should have went that route. But the matches, it was okay. It was solid, I thought. Dumb finish.
Yeah, like I say, it was okay. Not exciting. Another problem with the show is, we'll go over here too, is the they go backstage for backstage interviews with Missy Hyatt and a couple other people. And they had a lot of really pointless talking. So like the first one was they sent Missy, they threw it back to Missy, who basically then threw it back to the announcers again. It was kind of a really dumb segment. And the thing about Crockett at this point was they were built around all these really great talkers. Like you had Dusty Rhodes, you had Ric Flair, you had the Four Horsemen. And like none of them got to talk on this show. Like if you're reading like Nikita Koloff and I think it was like Dick Murdoch or something, it was just really, really bizarre choices of people to talk to, especially when there's lots of downtime from building cages and scaffolds and everything like that. So next up we had, for the UWF title, Steve Williams defending against Barry Windham. And this was kind of a dumpster fire of a match. It was just what I had heard reading on later was that Windham was injured, I guess, which was part of the problem. But I mean, like the booking was ridiculous. Like they went out and they had a boring match. And then of course they did the famous spot where Steve Williams gets hit in the groin when doing a leapfrog on Barry Windham, and Windham won't go in for the kill, and Williams is there playing with himself in the corner to get the blood flowing again, and then basically just immediately tosses Windham and pins him with a Oklahoma roll. And it didn't build anything in the match. It was a bad match.
Yeah,
the UWF title is, this is supposed to be the title situation in Crockett. We think it's bad today, but I mean, like, this was a UWF world title, second from the bottom of the card. Like, it's just how boring and pointless could you get with this thing?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke about SummerSlam this past Sunday, how I thought the match layout and some of the booking was questionable, but the first two matches of this show were worse than anything at SummerSlam, I thought. This match did suck. It really sucked. I think Williams bolted for Japan a couple weeks later, too, anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
But this match sucked. The UWF title looked like shit as a result, and yeah, it was terrible. Yep. These two guys are much better than this.
Yeah, well, Williams actually, he was actually supposed to turn heel and join the Varsity Club right away. But basically, he went to Japan for a tour, and Inoki pointed out to him quite rightly that he could make a lot more money just working, 15 or 16 weeks a year and staying in Japan than he would going back to the U.S. So he just kind of decided to stay there, and they put the kibosh on it. But his acting like a heel in this was actually supposed to be setting up a heel turn later on. Like that was building up to that. Meltzer was speculating at the time as well that Williams would end up being the fourth horseman after Luger left, but obviously that didn't pan out there either. But really disappointing from both guys, and especially for somebody like Windham, who was like, really high level guy at that point, and he was about to get the biggest push of his career coming up pretty soon after this as well. You would have thought that he'd be better in this one, but just was not. So next up, scaffold match. My favorite kind of match, of course. Midnight Express taking on the Rock and Roll Express. And really, I'm at this point, I was over the scaffold match concept to begin with. The Road Warriors Midnight Express one from the year earlier was kind of an interesting freak show one, but I don't know why they had to do a scaffold match here. I would have rather just seen a 4.5-star Midnight Express Rock and Roll Express match like they were doing around the horn. Rock and Roll Express wins here. And some interesting acrobatics from the Midnight Express, and so I'll give them that. That was not too bad, but I don't know. Just struck me as kind of pointless. Rock and Roll was on their way out of the promotion. They were actually gone a couple of months later. They ended up getting fired or quitting, depending on which version of the story that you believe. So it was really weird to put them over in a match like this here, and scaffold match didn't play to either of their strengths. So it was an okay scaffold match for what it is, I guess, but nothing I'd want to watch again.
Yeah, and like you, I'm not a fan of scaffold matches whatsoever. Thankfully, that's something Vince never did in WWF. I think the concept stinks. And I believe the Midnight Express are the U.S. tag champs at this point.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, like you said, just have a good match with the belts on the line instead of this crappy gimmick would have been a lot better.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And the thing is, too, it took up all this extra time to assemble and deassemble the scaffold. Nobody was buying a ticket to see this match. It was a waste of time. Speaking of wasting of time.
Jimmy, what an event, what a day. Oh! It has already been, but I know you're disappointed that you didn't win the match.
Well, I'm not that disappointed now, Bob, because I didn't lose the match either. You know, we didn't win, we didn't lose, but it was a good contest. Michael Hayes, myself, and I, and Sting, we feel confident that we had a good, exciting match. And the fact is this, I'm just really excited on behalf of my squeezed precious and Michael Hayes, Bob. I'd like to tell all the fans that I'm just glad to be a part of Starrcade 87. It's the most exciting event in all wrestling history. I mean, the fact is, I get excited because I think about all the careers that are on the line tonight. I mean, we're just this far through it. There's a lot more action to come. And when I think about the guys like Dusty Rhodes right now that must be just a little bit nervous because just in a few minutes, he's going to put his career on the line. Then you got the Road Warriors against Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard. And as far as I'm concerned about that, Bob, Michael Hayes and I are really concerned about that match because we want to challenge the winners of that match. It don't matter if it's the Road Warriors or if it's Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard. Everybody knows it's no secret. Squeeze and I and Michael, we've been talking about it. We want the World Tag Team titles. They're on our mind and we're going to get them. My brother Ronnie, I get goosebumps up and down my back when I think about him. I love him to death and I know if anything, this is his day. Starrcade 87 means a lot to everybody. Don't get me wrong, Bob. It means a lot to a lot of young careers. It means a lot to people that's been in this sport for many years. Myself, I'm just a proud with Michael and Squeeze to be a part of the National Wrestling Alliance and Jim Crockett and to be on the winning team in professional wrestling in the wide world today. And there's no doubt in anybody's mind that the National Wrestling Alliance has the greatest wrestlers in the world. And my brother Ronnie Garvin is at the top of the pile. He is the world heavyweight champion. I'd like to predict too, Michael. I do want to predict that it's not my fault, ladies and gentlemen, when my brother Ronnie keeps the world heavyweight title and defeats Ric Flair, because nobody knows more than I do. And I've sat down and talked with my brother Ronnie for several hours about this. It means a lot to him because he did have a great match, there's no doubt, when he defeated Ric Flair in Detroit. Absolutely. But the talk is this, that match was nothing compared to the match that's going to happen later on. I'm telling you one thing, it's really going to be exciting. I'm going to be right here. In fact, I'd be on the front row if I could, but there's no seats left out there. In fact, ladies, there's no seats left anywhere, and it's going to be fantastic. I do predict my brother to win and keep his world heavyweight title. I do predict my buddy, that rascal Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream's not going to let the world down. He's not going to have to go into retirement. And the Road Warriors, Arn Anderson thing, you know how I feel about that. And, of course, Nikita Koloff and Terry Taylor. You can't forget about a match like that. There's two individuals fighting for the National Wrestling Alliance against the UWF. And, of course, there's no question in anybody's mind, the greatest organization in the whole wide world. And we're very proud to be a part of it. It's the National Wrestling Alliance. I know you're going to tell me my time's run out, but I'm going to tell you I'm finished talking. And we got to go, so we'll see you later. Have a good evening.
And good luck to you.
The all-time greatest promo in YouTube history follows now, as Jimmy Garvin comes out with Michael Hayes to recap the evening in a literal time-wasting segment where he was told to go out and use up the 5 minutes that they needed to take the scaffolding down. So Jimmy Garvin literally goes out and talks for 5 minutes without taking a breath. Well, Michael Hayes just stands there dumbfounded and has to be silent for the first time in his life. And Dave Meltzer hated this promo with a passion back in 1987. It's actually really kind of funny reading about the vitriol that he has for it in those old observers. But it seems to have taken on a life of its own on YouTube since then. I think it's become kind of a legendary promo from Jimmy Garvin. also reveals the state of the drug scene, I guess, backstage at Crockett.
Yeah, that was amazing, this promo. Everybody should check this out online if they can. Guy runs out of his freaking mind in this one, and it's entertaining.
It is entertaining, yes. But unfortunately, it didn't accomplish anything, just like everything else.
No, it didn't.
All right, next up, the unification match for the two versions of the World Television title, Nikita Koloff against Terry Taylor. Terry Taylor was not a popular guy, to say the least, which is funny. I mean, I've never heard of him being like a jerk to anybody like that. But I guess there was a lot of bad blood towards him. He was brought in because he was TV champion, and he was working hot as a heel at that point. But it was kind of very reluctantly on Dusty Rhodes' part. Dusty didn't actually want to bring him in, is a story that I've heard. And because I guess Taylor had left abruptly at 85, and Dusty can hold a grudge. So they're kind of using him reluctantly. Yeah, so this was kind of the way they bring him in. They can job him out and then, you know, get rid of him, basically, is what it came down to, which is really strange. So, you know, luckily, Taylor ended up in the WWF, and he had his career revived as the Red Rooster, I guess.
But, yeah.
Poor guy, though. He just had a car accident, too, and everything like that. Literally had his guts ripped out, and then that's where he ends up. So, bad day to be Terry Taylor. But so the match was, I don't know, it was okay. Meltzer really, really hated it. Like, he was going to give it negative stars before the finish was it. I thought it was an okay story. Like, the story of the match was basically Terry Taylor and Eddie Gilbert trying to figure out how many ways they could cheat to stop Nikita Koloff from destroying him. And so that's kind of what it was building to. It was Nikita Koloff completely destroying him for about 10 minutes. And then finally Taylor is able to figure out a strategy and work through it. It ended up being a good match, I thought. The others really hated it, but I think it has aged pretty well, especially compared to some of the other stuff from Nikita around that time. Like, it was a decent match. It wasn't, you know, Ric Flair and Nikita or anything like that, but I mean, like, it was Nikita kind of working the arm and that. It was fine. And overly long, I'd say, like a lot of other things on this show, but it's 19 minutes in and Nikita pins him with a sickle to unify the belts, and, you know, that was fine.
I don't think it was a negative star match or anything. I don't know what Meltzer was talking about with that match. The match was fine. Like you said, maybe a little bit too long. But it wasn't a bad match or anything at all.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Taylor was gone shortly after this, wasn't he?
Taylor lasted... He just got fired in the issue of the Observer. I just recapped from February. So, yeah, he was around for another 2 months. But the thing is, after he lost the title here, he was literally a job guy. And Crockett from then on, like he got beat like a drum week after week on TV until finally he decided to leave.
And it's funny because Taylor himself said that the only reason he got hired in the WWF because he kept on calling Pat Patterson because he needed money, and he called every month for about 5 or 6 months, and Patterson finally agreed to hire him if he'd stop calling.
Yeah, yep,
that's how he said he got the job. And then he got the Red Rooster gimmick, and holy shit, that was bad.
Yeah, well, that's how the wrestling business goes sometimes.
Yeah.
He was actually, Taylor did really well for himself, I thought, in Memphis and World Class after he left Crockett. Like, he had really good stuff going on in World Class. But, I mean, obviously the money was going to be in WWF if he was going to. Taylor was not, you know, a super young guy.
No.
I think it was, like I say, because he had been in a car accident, you know, it was kind of a limited time frame on what he could do. So, you know, he needed the money, so I can understand what he did. All right, so next up, the match that killed Chicago. The Road Warriors challenging Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson for the World Tag Team Championship. I thought it was one of the better matches of the show, but boy, talk about a misguided booking decision here. The idea was that this was the famous Dusty finish. The Road Warriors looked like they had won the titles from Tully and Arn. The Doomsday Device and pin Arn, but then it turns out that the original referee had seen Arn getting tossed over the top rope, so with a DQ finish. And boy, oh boy, why they had to do that in Chicago is completely beyond me. It's been insinuated that, you know, that there's issues with the Road Warriors and they didn't want to put the titles on them for whatever reason, the contract things or what, but I mean, God, like, of all the places you could choose to screw over the fans, this is not the one that I do. And in fact, later on It turned out that they returned to Chicago a couple of months later, and basically they drew half the people that they did here. So obviously it was not good for Crockett in the city from now.
No, it was just a terrible decision. What was a good match otherwise?
It was a good match, yeah.
Terrible ending.
Yeah.
At this point of the show, just a lot of bad booking in the show. Really tons of bad booking. But yeah, they ended up killing Chicago, and the promotion really struggled after this point too. And yeah, just Dusty was just not doing a good job whatsoever with the book at this point.
And he was still around for another year after that, which is astonishing as booker. Speaking of Dusty, next up, the U.S. title match with Lex Luger against Dusty Rhodes in a cage match. And if Dusty loses, he's out of wrestling for 90 whole days. Like, Brock Lesnar takes more than that off between matches. It's crazy. This was by far the worst match of the show. Like, just Lex Luger was just not really great at this point in his career. And Dusty Rhodes was not the guy to get a great match out of him. And I don't even know why he was in a cage match. And the story of the match was Dusty trying to go for a sleeper hold the whole time. So, yeah, just a whole conflagration of bad stuff coming together. The finish was pretty decent, I thought. J.J. Dillon throws a chair into the ring, and Lex bends over to pick it up, and Dusty DDTs it on him. Except it was in slow motion, so it wasn't as good as it could have been. But it was a terrible match, and of course Dusty has to book himself to go over on the biggest show of the year because he couldn't get the world title. And put himself over the hottest new star, Lex Luger. And I don't know, there was a lot of leeway given to Dusty after he died, obviously. And a lot of rose-colored glasses with the things. But watching this stuff back again, some of the decisions he made were just completely ludicrous.
Yeah. Even having this the cage match to begin with, when the main event was also a cage match, which is a little questionable, too.
Yeah. It's crazy stuff.
And the match wasn't very good, like you said.
There was one point when poor Lex had to try to get him up for a torture rack. It just looked like he was trying to deadlift a killer whale or something. It was kind of a car wreck, unfortunately, this match.
Yeah, Johnny Weaver is the doorkeeper, keeper whatever he was.
Keeper of the key, that's right. Yep.
Keeper of the key.
Yep. Gatekeeper in Ghostbusters, I guess. Okay, and finally, the main event, quote-unquote. Ronnie Garvin defending the world title against Ric Flair. Ronnie, the ratings killer, Garvin. I have become more open-minded to Garvin, I think, in previous years. I didn't like him when I was a kid, but I think he grew on me a lot. But this was not the time for him to be world champion. If anything, the time was the previous year. He was a lot hotter in 86. 87, it was almost Jimmy Garvin that should have been put in that position rather than Ronnie. Match was not great, not terrible, but like it was... I don't know if you've seen the original match they had in Detroit where Garvin won the world title, but that was a much better match. That was like a four-star match, basically, they had in the cage in Detroit there. This one was, they did a lot of chops, and it was, like I say, it was okay-ish, but it did not feel like a real main event match. For whatever reason, Flair just seemed kind of out of it compared to his usual stuff. And even the finish was weird. Garvin was trying his sunset flip thing again, and just ended up Flair caught him and hotshotted him into the cage and pinned him to win the title. So back on Flair, yay. Total meaningless titling from Ronnie Garvin. Not a great main event.
No, underwhelming as a main event. As a match, it was fine, but didn't have a main event feel to it. And like you said, Garvin was just not a main event player in 87 anyway at this point. Speaking of Garvin, I actually started to get to the point in my WWF watch in late 88, 89. His matches with Valentine are great. They hold up. That was a mid-card feud, which is fine for him at that point. But at this point, in 87, he didn't belong anywhere near the main event scene. And just a really disappointing show overall this was.
Yeah, exactly. That's the main thing. It was supposed to be the introduction to pay-per-view, and it was not great, unfortunately.
And he had a crowd that wanted a great show, and they gave him the worst possible show they could with a card they put out.
Yep. Oh, kind of like SummerSlam, I guess.
Oh, well. A little bit. SummerSlam was better than this, though.
Yeah, a little bit. Oh, yeah, John Cena. So, yeah. All right. Well, anyway, that's we're up against our time limit here, I think, tonight. So I want to thank Brian for joining us here once again on the podcast to do.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. Any plugs you want to get in before we wrap it up here tonight?
You can check out my work here on Place to Be Nation or at blogadoom.com, which tomorrow I'll be reviewing the Honky Tonk Man You Shoot, which is a honky's drunk on a – he's drinking Gatorade and tequila in a Gatorade bottle during the interview. And he shoots in that interview. I'll tell you that right now. So he drops a lot of stuff in that one.
He once sent me a threatening voicemail.
He did.
Yeah. Doesn't shock. Actually, yeah. All right. Well, anyways, once again, thanks for joining us here on the Podcast of Doom. My name is Scott Keith, and join us back here in 2 weeks when apparently Brian will not be available. We'll figure something out. So thanks a lot, and have a good night.